Welcome back to the Helpful Gardeners Podcast. Well, this week, Colin, it's a very special week because we have a brand new guest with us, Myrna Pyramid.
Our first guest in our new studio.
I know, it's so exciting.
I love it.
Well, today we're going to talk all about backyard birding with you. But first, Colin, we have to wrap up our seed starting mini series.
That was pretty good, eh?
It was really good. We ended up getting so many comments, and I have to share a few because they just tickled me. So we had that episode on squashes, gourds, all of that. We had somebody on YouTube message us and said that squash flowers are very loved in Mexican culture.
Okay.
And that you can eat them with quesadillas.
And you can eat anything with a quesadilla. Quesadillas are delicious.
I mean, yes. Have you ever tried squash flowers, Myrna?
Have not. But we have a gourd here, and I would like to just share a little bit of information about a gourd. So this is a perfect segue talking about the world's oldest birdhouse is a gourd.
No.
Yes. So 10,000 years ago, the early American Indians grew these gourds. They would hang them outside their villages. They'd poke a little hole in, and a bird called a purple martin would nest beside the villages. And the villagers loved them because they would alert them if a bobcat came through or a cougar. And of course, they just loved watching the birds. And the birds loved to nest near people. So for 10,000 years, these birds called purple martins have nested by humans because it all started with a gourd.
What another reason to love gourds, eh?
But that's so cool, too, is that, you know, you think, at least I do, now when we look at all the stuff we've gotten, all the types of seeds and all the houses and ceramics and plastics and composites and everything else, and you get tricked into thinking that this is a relatively new hobby. You know, it's a relatively new pastime. And then you're like, oh, it was 10,000 years ago. Whatever. Whatever.
So we had
North American natives were the original bird hipsters.
But here's another really cool comment we got on our melons gourds episode. You mentioned salt on watermelon.
Oh heck yes.
So I thought I was like of the majority of not knowing that this was a thing. And I guess we had somebody reach out and say, we had user Kenny M. Olson say, grew up with my mom showing me how to eat it that way sometimes.
Yeah.
What?
It's so good.
Yeah. Somebody else said it's so good. Yep. You've never tried it, Myrna?
I have not, but I will.
Yeah,
especially in the summer. The watermelon has got to be cold and not heavy, just a little bit.
Had no idea. Mm-hmm. And we got an email from Alyssa who said that they were listening to the March 24th episode, which I believe was all about like the ground dwellers.
Okay, right.
So eggplant and all of that. They agree if a veggie or a fruit isn't prepared well, you don't want to keep trying it.
Nope.
For her, it's banana bread and carrot cake. Doesn't like it.
Bad banana bread is still good banana. Bad banana bread is better than no banana. I love our listeners, but I got to be honest, like I'm disagreeing on that.
But here's the thing though. Love eggplants, but understand why Colin doesn't. They usually make an eggplant pie, which is layers of sliced onions, red peppers, eggplant, vegan parm, mozzarella. There's also vegetable lasagna with eggplant in it. Do you like eggplant?
No.
You and Colin are on the same wavelength.
Well, all I'm saying is if Alyssa wanted to change my mind on eggplant and wanted to bring in eggplant pie, I could do an episode on me eating eggplant pie. Yeah.
Come on the podcast, Alyssa. Let's do a cooking
segment. And you know what? Challenge accepted. I would gladly make Alyssa some of my banana bread.
Mm-hmm. There you go, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I want to introduce Myrna Pyramid because I'm so happy you're here. You're a biologist, an author, nature photographer. You live in Sylvan Lake, Alberta.
I do, right on the south shore of Sylvan Lake. This is gorgeous view office.
You were raised on a farm northeast of Rimby, Alberta, though. Where is Rimby?
Rimby's just north of Sylvan Lake.
Oh, okay.
Northwest of Ridger.
Yeah. And then you became interested in nature photography while you were in high school. It's been a lifelong love.
I was the high school yearbook photographer. Mm-hmm. One of our teachers was a very amazing photographer. Mm-hmm. And sadly, he got ill. But while I was in high school, he taught me about using the old single lens reflex cameras. And I became the high school yearbook photographer. And then when he passed away, he actually gave me all his equipment.
Wow.
Which was a real gift.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very encouraging. So that kind of sparked my interest.
You retired in 2020 after a 3-decade career at Ellis Bird Farm here in Alberta. And you're also a fellow of the Royal Canadian Geographical Society and resident naturalist for Mother Nature's Seeds, which is what we're seeing here.
What we're going to talk about today.
Yes.
Yes. And I wrote the book.
You wrote the book.
So while I was at Ellis Bird Farm, I wrote this book called Backyard Bird Feeding, an Alberta Guide. It has sold almost 10,000 copies.
Wow.
It made Ellis Bird Farm, which is a nonprofit company, over $100,000 profit.
Wow.
So from the sale proceeds from this book, we set up an education legacy fund.
Aww.
Yeah, so I do know a little bit about this, and it is my passion, and I'm thrilled to be the resident naturalist for Mother Nature's Seeds.
Yeah, we found Mother Nature's Seeds, I don't know, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, maybe, and we were looking at expanding birding and whatnot, like from a company point of view. You know, you consider yourself pretty savvy in the business world, and you're like, they're 2 hours down the road in Tabor. They do all of, like, they've got this incredible lineup, and we were kind of like very sheepishly got a hold of them, and they sent out a rep, and it has been amazing. People, Albertans, especially, they love supporting Albertan.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever it gets mentioned, people are just taking them off the shelves, and they love the fact, plus bright yellow bags, instantly gets the eyes. So yeah, it's a great company. And then they give us access to talk to people like you so we can nerd out.
Yeah.
Win-win.
We use their product for decades at Ellis Bird Farm. And yes, excellent quality.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that it's a family-owned business from Tabor. And we are supporting local by
exactly.
Them.
Yep.
And it is excellent quality.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go into talking more about birds, because I think that there are lots of benefits to having birds in your backyard as gardeners. Can we talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. I would just like to do a push for my other book.
Yes.
So this book is called Naturescape Alberta, Creating and Caring for Wildlife Habitat at Home. I'm here to tell you it took me 4 years, 4 years of my life. I made 11 cents an hour. All of the proceeds go to our local nature club, Red River Naturalist.
Cool.
It was really a labor of love. And at the end, it was just a labor.
Fair enough, yep.
So it's a huge comprehensive book about improving biodiversity in your backyard. So it's
birds and
bees and butterflies and frogs and toads and salamanders and mammals.
Well, they all need to be healthy in order to thrive. You can't just isolate one. That's what, you know, Brandy and I have talked about this so much, is that diversity is key in the garden.
Totally.
You've got to have it. You can have your little ornate area, like your little patch of perfect Kentucky blue lawn and a patio, but offset that with some wild area, with some cover, with, you know, water. And I love the fact that you advocate for that, because we've been saying it for years. So
awesome. And that's a big book.
It's
a big book.
It's all about create the habitat. So create the habitat and they will come.
Mm.
And what is habitat? Habitat is space within which creatures can find food, water, and shelter. So really, you just break it down like that.
Yeah.
And even if people have a small balcony, they can still provide habitat. And if you think about habitat, it's three-dimensional, right? So as high as birds fly in the sky to as low as microbial activity takes place in the soil, that's habitat. It's three-dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
So even small yards and gardens can provide.
Thank you for saying that. Like I have a townhouse with, I always say, I don't have anything. I don't have any garden. Like how can I help any of the ecosystems that are going on in my place? So I'm really interested to learn more about that.
You don't have to have a massive wilderness. You can have a small yard. Now, if your yard is hooked to your neighbor's yard and you have this patchwork of habitat, then that's even better. And even in cities, actually, I went to a very interesting informational seminar about bees, native bees, and cities support more native bee populations in even rural areas because of this patchwork of habitat.
What?
Yeah, because a lot of the rural areas, it's just acres, countless acres of one crop. It's monoculture.
Right.
Oh.
And speaking of monoculture, so Kentucky bluegrass, you mentioned earlier, I feel that the classic lawn is basically an ecological desert. And so if we can have a little bit of lawn area, but reduce the lawn area and create habitat in those other spaces,
mm-hmm.
so just give this habitat so that you can support biodiversity.
Yeah.
And that's a great idea. and don't use cosmetic pesticides.
Aha.
Yeah. A couple of years ago, we started bringing in lawn category, lawn alternative, is the fastest growing category in the store. Now, it's a tiny percentage, but the growth it has gone through is ridiculous. We couldn't keep lawn alternatives on the shelf. I love the fact that you're saying that because it just really makes me smile.
Yeah. Awesome. So yep. There is a place for the lawn. You know, even in my place, we have a small area of lawn. But like you say, if we can just get away from that perfectly manicured, toxic landscape and create habitat, then our lives will be enriched because then we'll be sharing it with so many wild creatures.
Actually, on that same wavelength, maybe we can sort of skip ahead to maybe with that less lawn, moving into creating more plants that are more bird and butterfly and pollinator friendly.
So go and see what grows on those hills. See what grows in the areas around here. And if you can, try to use those plants, plantings.
Smart.
Curves, clumps, and clusters. Colin, you mentioned your yard is kind of like a mess. And nature loves a mess. Nature doesn't like straight lines. And variety. Variety is very, very important. So the more species you can plant, the better. So again, instead of those monocrops. And really, the best thing we can do, unless there's issues with invasives. So sometimes invasive plants are an issue. But if you don't have invasives and you've bought some new property and you have nature in the corner, do not touch it. Just leave it. Mother Nature has evolved over millennia. These insects and these flowers have evolved together. Leave it or let it naturalize. So you can put out a bird bath and you have the birds coming in to bathe the next day. Or you wait for 20 years and you have a snag. And a snag means a dead or dying tree. A dead tree supports more life centimeter per centimeter than a live tree. So these old dead trees are super important.
So you've repurposed something that most people would have thrown away, but then now it's able to serve another purpose in life.
And lots of people, in fact, I've read in gardening magazines where people go out and plant a snag.
Really?
So they go out to the woods, find a dead tree, and plant it in their yard.
That's so fun.
I know there's some people who they repurpose their Christmas tree like that.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
When Christmas is over in January and they take the tree down, instead of throwing it straight into the pile for the city or chopping it up into their green box, they'll stake it, just kind of boom, right into the snowbank. Some people might even hang little feeders on it. Yeah. And then the birds have, because some people, again, have small areas, they can't have a spruce tree or a conifer tree. So they stick that in and it kind of has that effect for the birds, temporary effect.
That's cool.
And it's shelter. So that's a really important thing about deciduous or coniferous trees. My project right now is to photograph hummingbirds. So I'm working on that. I'm actually on my way down to Texas and I'm going to be photographing hummingbirds.
Cool.
This is at my place and you'll see this is a dead branch. Every time a hummingbird wants to rest or it wants to perch to feed on a flower, it will find something dead. So dead bits are very important. So it'll not only perch, but they'll also, if you've got an old dead branch sticking out, they always like to sit on the end. So they're always at the very end. And lots of birds will sit on those dead branches. So they sit to sing. Mm-hmm. They sit to just check out their territory. And they will hawk for insects. So there's so many species that actually just sit on the edge of a tree. And they'll just look out and they'll go, oh, there's a bug flying by. And that's what is called hawking. Mm-hmm. So dead trees, dead branches are very important.
And I guess it's a safety thing too, because they're up high. So if any predators come, they've got the ability to get out of there. They're not kind of isolated somewhere.
Right.
So
look around. Yeah.
So all the times when people are saying I put out hummingbird feeders, but I don't get hummingbirds.
Saving a few dead branches is a way to contribute to biodiversity.
Way to make me feel bad, Myrna. I didn't know you were going to come on the show and do that. So
Sorry about that.
No, but it's true. Like if you ever get a comment from somebody else saying, well, why haven't you pruned that dead branch off? And be like, well, actually, it's a bigger purpose.
But I love that because it allows me to inherently be even lazier. So now instead of going out and pruning, I can be like, for the birds, for the birds. The trees on my house. Yeah. It's like, for the birds.
It was very funny. I had a barbecue at my place one evening and I had an arborist out. And so we're all sitting around on my deck. He looks over at my laurel leaf willow and I can just see him wither.
Yeah. He's like, where's your pruners?
Yeah. And I'm like, listen, the birds have found love there. They've made love there. They've fed their babies. They brought their babies back. They sit there. They hawk. Like there's so many things that happen in that country.
Yep. a couple of dead branches isn't going to make my yard ugly, and it's going to encourage more birds, and I'm all about increasing the diversity. So learning that, honestly, that is fantastic, because I am always like, it's dead, it's gone, it's dead, it's gone. Keep the plant going. And mm-hmm. and I've been absolutely guilty of that. So that's my takeaway from this episode for sure. Mm-hmm. Love that.
So what's next? What do we have to think about next?
Okay, so the next thing we'll think about is food. Okay. So this is a little baby redneck grebe. So it's a water bird. And I found a nest right beside the edge of this walkway and spent 3 solid days photographing. But they ride on their parents' back in the water. And so one will be like on the mothership and the other adult comes in and feeds them. And then they go back in the nest and they have a snooze under her wings or his wings, the dad. They both take turns. And then when they're ready to feed, they just pop out. They're like little zebras.
Is it because they can't swim or is it for safety?
Okay, so both? There are 2 main kinds of baby birds. One are called precocial, so it's a baby duck. It comes out of the egg and it swims. It's ready for life.
Yep.
The other is altricial, so that's like the mountain bluebirds. They're hatched blind, naked, and helpless. They need to be fed and looked after. These are in between. Oh. So they can jump off the nest right after they've hatched, but they can't swim for long periods of time, and they have issues thermoregulating. So if the water's cold, they'll get cold. They're not as well adapted as baby ducks. So it is so amazing to watch. The adult will put out its foot into the water and they climb up like onto a ship. I know, it's the most incredible thing to watch. And so they'll be under the wing to stay warm. And then when the other adult comes with food, it is hilarious to watch. So there'll be like 3-4 of these little zebras tucked under the wing. And then the adult will come from the back. They must emit some sort of sound. And then all the heads come out the back.
What?
One lucky one gets the leech or the fish, and then they all go back to sleep. The next food delivery can come from the front, right? And so they must make a sound and then all the heads come out. Yeah. And then when they get older, it's very funny to watch because the parents are like, okay, you're teenagers, you can.
Yeah, I'm not giving you a piggyback.
Yeah. And so that will get up in the water and just shake. And the baby's off.
Oh, no.
And then the adult swims off and the little babies are like, no, wait.
Oh, yes,
so cute. I wonder how many of our listeners thought that the only things bird eats are seeds and suet. Like I'm sure I thought that for the longest time. I didn't think that live insects and nectar would have been on the menu.
Right. So really, most birds eat insects.
Oh.
So the reason the birds migrate mm-hmm. is because we have long hours of daylight and a flush of insects in the summer. So they can find food. I had a friend who had a brown thrasher and it ate bran muffins all winter. And he fed it bran muffins like every 2 or 3 days. And the brown thrasher lived.
That's so
cute. There must have been something wrong with it, right? Injured or something.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't able to make its migration and...
Something in his brain didn't work.
Yeah.
But it lived.
Something in my brain doesn't work, so I'm team brown thrasher.
Bran muffins, yeah. That's
so cute.
If you
could some bran muffins, that would be great.
So the best thing we can do in our yards is support the bugs.
Okay.
We have been taught, right? I was taught. I'm a biologist. And even in school, it's like, and my mom was a wonderful farm woman, but those aphids, I have to spray the aphids. I have to get rid of the insects, right? So now that we know how important insects are, this is what we need to do is support the beneficial insects. So the insects are really the underpinnings of the ecosystem. They are the underpinnings. Without the insects, it's over.
Yeah, it falls apart.
Everything collapses.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So that's the way we can provide food. So we can put the plantings, those beautiful plants that you sell, attracts the insects, then that attracts the birds. So you set up the...
Everything is
the
site.
Ecosystem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm going to quickly just touch on chemical sprays because we mentioned them a couple of times. I'm not a huge fan of them. I believe that they should be used, if at all, only when there is a major issue you can't get around.
And there are issues.
Exactly. Right. You've got a out-of-control noxious weed or an infestation of bugs. You don't need to go out and spray all the time. Let there be a balance. Let those ladybirds come in. Let the other ones, and then get the birds in. And I couldn't tell you the last time I used a chemical spray, and I plant tomatoes and peppers and cucumbers every year. Did no spraying. I was like, I'm just going to keep an eye out. So I'd go out and constantly check my plants. Never got out of control. No. You know, and again, it's finding that balance. And think how much more under control I would have got it if I had some dead branches.
Yes. Oh, well, you'll start doing that. And the other thing that we want to do is, of course, to attract hummingbirds. Who doesn't want to attract hummingbirds? Now, lots of people think all I have to do to attract hummingbirds is put out a hummingbird feeder.
I thought so.
Yes.
Bright red feeder.
Yeah, it's got to have a red component on it. Well, just think about us living on a steady diet of sugar, right? So it's not a complete food. It's a good supplemental food, but it's not a complete food. So the best thing you can do is plant plantings that will attract the hummingbirds.
Oh.
And then you're almost guaranteed. Mm. Yeah. Oh, and this is interesting. So yellow-bellied sapsucker. Now, I really would like to share some information about the yellow-bellied sapsucker.
Yes.
So they are a native woodpecker that migrates, okay? So they rely on nectar. So, of course, they can't stay the winter here. And so the yellow-bellied sapsucker comes in the spring, and it follows, it will do what's called test wells. So it'll drill a hole in a tree, and it'll taste the sap. If the sap is sweet, that means that the tree is sick and dying. So in nature, the yellow-bellied sapsucker only goes to trees that are already doomed. Okay, so they never attack a really healthy tree. Now, they will, though, go for some cultivars, like some of the birch species and the Scots pine. But in the native ecosystem, they'll only go after the dead and dying trees.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you'll see on the right here is a little hummingbird. If we didn't have yellow-bellied sapsuckers, we would not have ruby-throated hummingbirds.
Wow.
Because the ruby-throated hummingbird has no blossoms when it first arrives in the spring. It only has the sapwell orchards from the yellow-bellied sapsucker. So if you can leave a tree or two to the yellow-bellied sapsucker, you are doing the earth a favor.
That is great information. Wow.
Yeah, I had no idea. And it's kind of nice that because I bet you a lot of people just instantly thought, they're like, oh, like they just see the surface, right?
Yeah.
But they don't actually know about the background information. And if you want hummingbirds.
So they sometimes, like I said, I have laurel leaf willows in my yard, and they have hastened the deaths of these laurel leaf willows. So why plant laurel leaf willows is the question, right?
Mm.
Why not plant, if you don't want the yellow-bellied sapsucker, then plant species that they're not so attracted to.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But if you have a single Scots pine and you have the sapsucker on it and you can sacrifice that tree, I mean, there is a little island of biodiversity.
Oh my gosh. Not only that, if that tree is doomed and does die, then it will also serve the purpose of shelter, like we were talking about before, right?
And then become a snake.
There you go.
You top it at, you know, 3 or 4 meters, and that's just a beautiful thing. So deciduous trees and shrubs are also very important for bees, butterflies, and moths, not only as for nectar, but as larval food. So this is what we can do to provide food. Just get as many shrubs are fast growing, as you know, and they blossom early. And so you can just get a whole wide variety of different types of trees that offer different types of blossoms. So in my book, I have a list of some of the really good perennials and annuals that are excellent for insects.
Okay.
So more species eat sunflowers than any other plant.
Oh, really? we were just hyping.
Number one.
We were, like last week we talked about flowers and we were talking about our love for the sunflower and how it's just one, but it creates so much benefit for the ecosystem. I love that it's also good for birds.
Yeah, I've seen some of the huge ones when they're pollinated and the seeds are in the head and you'll see birds landing and pulling the seeds straight out of them.
Yeah, they will do that. Even fuchsias, you can hang those.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel so. If anybody's having trouble and they really want to see hummingbirds, you know, try looking at flowers, you know, along with the nectar, and just see if
and
you have better
branches.
Luck this year. And the dead branches.
Flowers. That's my takeaway. Yeah. I'm not letting that one go.
I'm going to put like on our blog. So go to our website, goldenacre.ca/blog. I'm going to put together like a little hummingbird recipe sheet.
Yeah. And you need water. So the cutest thing, last summer, I took my garden hose, just put the wand on mister. It was late in the summer. It was hot. So all I did is take the garden hose, put it up to a stepladder. So it aimed into that beautiful little cotoneaster shrub, and I just misted the tree. And that little hummingbird came in and spent so much time
beating. Mm-hmm.
And if you want to put out, you have lots of good feeders here.
Mm-hmm.
1 part white sugar, 4 quarts water. Leave it out till it gets moldy. Like, just put out a little bit at a time. Don't use honey. Don't use brown sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And ants can be a problem, but I see you sell a lot of feeders now that have a little container in the top. You put water in there, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's an ant moat.
Yeah, the ant moat.
Ants can't get across.
Okay, yeah. What's this one?
Okay, so this is a really easy bird to attract in your backyard by just putting out an orange half. And this is a beautiful Baltimore Oriole. They have become so common throughout Alberta. It's incredible. And they
Is that new? Is that
I would say in the last 6 or 7 years.
Okay.
They have learned to come in to, and they've changed their diet. So normally they're insectivorous in the summer, but they've changed their diet to eating orange halves and jelly. So grape jelly, any kind of jelly you can put out. So if you've got, you know, cranberry jelly, been in your downstairs pantry for 10 years, just pull it out and throw it out in the, yeah, the Orioles just love it.
I've never identified with a bird so much.
Oh, really? Yeah, they are beautiful.
I love this. Yeah. I love jelly too.
A number of years ago.
Poor chickadee may be usurped by the Oriole. At my place, in the last 3 years, they've just become super common. And this is a great segue to Mother Nature's sunflower chips. So we have medium chips here. So the number one herb seed, not only the number one plant is the sunflower plant, but of course the number one seed is sunflower seed. So you can serve it whole,
okay,
which is great. And lots of birds will open it up. And of course they have to extract the nut meat. But the shells have a growth inhibitor in them. So you get a whole bunch of shells on your lawn. It will kind of make a mess and it will inhibit the growth. So the best, absolute best, and every bird but a hummingbird will feed on the shelled sunflower seeds.
Oh, nice.
And I love the medium chips. They have fine chips, but this is just an amazing offering.
Mm-hmm.
Even the Orioles, the yellow-bellied sapsucker, which is generally a nectar feeder, insect feeder, will come into sunflower chips.
Oh.
I have photos of my place.
Wild. Okay.
So that's like your all-purpose fertilizer. Yeah. It's like, just get this. And then, you know,
good starting point.
Yeah.
Good starting point. Yeah. And then they have the number one blend, which I just love, is this No Mess Gardener's
Mix. I love that one too.
Yeah. So it's got the peanuts in it, a few cranberries, and it's got the various size of chips.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of like the ultimate.
And
I just fence this very, rational.
Beautifully named as well. That one, No Mess Gardener, because we had birders, clients who were into birding, and the mess and the weeds, I think it was millet that was growing up under it and you couldn't get rid of it and it's turning moldy. Now there's slugs attracted to it and it wasn't pleasant. I'm not going to lie. It was a bit of a pain in the butt. And then that one, I'm loving that one.
Yeah.
The only caution is that, and it's no fault of the manufacturers, it's that sunflowers have oil, right? Sunflower seeds have oil. So if you have a brand new, very expensive deck, and the seeds do fall, there is a bit of oil that could stain your deck.
Mm.
So minor detail.
Yeah.
I put a little plate under mine so it doesn't fall.
A but small you're right, price to pay for one of those guys.
Small price, small price. Now, peanuts are great. So bag of peanuts, I see you sell.
Do they do anything with the shell on the peanuts do they just discard it?
Yeah,
the
cell, they just discard it. Can do some arts and crafts?
No, I thought, you know, sharpen their beak or something. Okay. I don't know.
Yeah.
Something.
Well, they might. And then, of course,
look at this little snow.
Mother Nature's has this incredible product. So this is new. It's the seed log. So it's in gelatin. It not only has peanuts and sunflower seeds, but it's got soldier fly larvae. So
whoa.
Very, very nutritious. And I see, and I'm very happy to see that you sell the cage. Mother Nature's gave me two samples, because I do testing of their seeds.
Yeah.
And I was so happy because I'm like, yes, I've got these seed logs. And the chickadees were at them. As you can see by this photo, it was 48 below that morning at my house. Look at the little chickadees covered in frost.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were still out pecking. This was very important nutrition for them.
And I'll bet you can see the worms right in it there too. Yeah.
Yes. So I hung it out and I brought it in for the first two nights. I remembered. And the third night, I didn't remember to bring it in the house. Well, I have flying squirrels in my place. Flying squirrels are beautiful little nighttime mammals. And it had snowed over the night. And I looked out my window and went, oh, no. All there was the rope.
No!
And here is their little footprints across the deck. And in one night, they've taken
the They took
thing.
The whole
they
thing?
The whole thing.
So it's
so that's why these cages are excellent.
We hung one when we got them in. We hung one in a tree. And I don't think it made it through the first day. It wasn't a flying squirrel. It was just a good old gray squirrel and just Yeah. Straight through the rope, yeah. Dropped it,
yeah.
And then
yeah, yeah.
Game
so
over.
It is really, okay. Really. So yeah. I've been now testing this cage at my place, and it's been a week, and it's still there. So
nice.
That's
okay.
Really important.
Yeah.
Okay, so we can offer suet too. So typically the seeds are for seed-eating birds.
Oh, okay.
The suet is for insect-eating birds. Okay. But there's lots of crossover. So Mother Nature has this great little mixture. It's a suet cake. So you can, if you know somebody who hunts or you have a friendly butcher, you can get the raw suet and just hang it out. But these suet cakes are so easy to dispense. So
yeah.
Just pop them out and put them in the little dispenser. So that will bring in species.
How long did these last? Like,
it depends.
Oh, it depends. Okay.
So if you have a pileated woodpecker like I do, just a few days.
Okay.
But if you don't have that many birds coming in, they can even last a week or more.
Oh, great.
Yeah. So
yeah.
These little suet cakes are easy. Mm-hmm. And this is a really good quality one. The pine
is it? Is it true that they're very important, or more important, one could say, in the winter because of the high fat in them for
yes,
the birds? Okay.
Definitely more important.
Perfect. Because I have heard that, but I've literally heard it on Google. So that's why I like to ask people
yeah.
like you. Cause
mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is a good segue to another part about bird feeding, because often you hear that you can't stop feeding. If you like, shouldn't really go to Palm Springs in February because, oh my goodness, your birds are all going to die because the feeders are going to go empty and they're going to just not survive. Totally not true.
Mm-hmm.
So any bird that has concentrated its winter activities on only one food source, its genes have long since left the gene pool, right? They don't survive. They need large winter territories. And so you don't have to worry about letting your feeders go empty. Mm-hmm. However, putting out the suet in the winter and the seeds will help
the
survival rate of these species.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Definitely.
Okay.
And you don't need to really feed peanuts in the summer. Now, I feed all year round, but I don't put the suet cakes out in the summer. So you're right. It gets warm and they get super
melty and kind of gross.
But still, there's the birds that come in, like the orioles and even the sapsuckers to the sunflower chips.
Oh, you could put out the jelly with the peanut butter and make your oriole peanut butter jelly time. Sorry. I take very small bits of the podcast and that's where it goes in.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So this is a bird that would never come into a bird feeding station.
Oh,
okay. So what we do is put out plantings. That's the most important thing we can do to attract birds and support biodiversity, as we talked. Don't use cosmetic pesticides. The next thing we can do is supplement that natural food with the supplemental food sources, especially in the winter. Very important. And the wonderful thing about putting out bird feeding stations is, as we've talked, brings nature to us.
Mm-hmm.
So it's as much about our hearts as it is about the survival of these birds. And very important. I think it's just so important. No wonder it's so popular.
Yeah.
It does something to our souls.
100%.
Yes.
Yep.
But if we want to attract different birds to our backyard, then we put out water. And more species will come to water than will come to food.
Mm-hmm.
Even supplemental food or flowers.
I've heard, and I don't know, again, I'll ask you, but I've heard if you're new and you haven't established that there's water there, it can help. Having a small fountain or having something because
the sound.
Okay, perfect.
Oh,
the sound of running water is extremely important.
Oh,
yeah, so that's what brings them in. You're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
At the Ellis Bird Farm, we actually had in our butterfly garden a mud source, a salty mud source. And so this was just a pot into which we had etched a little hole, and then the water just dripped down into this little mud patch. And you put table salt in there and you bring in the butterflies. So it's called a butterfly puddling area. Male butterflies need to give micronutrients to the females when they breed. So they have this little sperm sac in which are micronutrients. And so this is one way you can provide.
Is that why you see those little blue butterflies all the time on the mud flats in the...
Yeah, so you can do that right in your backyard. Just have a little
medicine. That is so cool. Okay, I've seen, I've got pictures of them. So
sure.
I was like, why are they all here? Them.
Yeah.
And like hundreds of them on the mud flats. And
what's on the mud flat is some coyotes come by and pee there. So that's where they get their micronutrients, generally from animal urine.
Obviously, you know, like you said, when you were feeding that chickadee, it was minus 43. You put water out, it's going to freeze real quick. You can't be out there all the time changing the water, but if you establish a schedule and at 8 o'clock every morning or 4 o'clock every afternoon, you put out water and the birds know that, they'll start coming around because water is so scarce in the winter, they kind of remember where it is and how to find it. Is there any truth to that?
So that, I have to admit, this is the first time I've ever heard that.
Okay.
But let me just explain how water works in the winter for these birds. So birds can eat snow. All of our native winter birds have adapted to eating snow.
Okay.
So the thing with snow, though, is they have to melt it in their system first, right? That takes energy. So if there's open water, they will avail themselves of that and come and drink. Our native birds, our little chickadees, our waxwings, they will never bathe when it's too cold to safely do so.
Yeah.
So that's how smart they are. So you can have a heated bird bath. I mean, and they're inexpensive. You can use an old Winnie Ellis from the Ellis Bird Farm used to put out an old electric frying pan, just turned on very low and put a rock in the middle.
Oh, that's so smart.
Or you can use a dog dish.
Yeah.
A big rock in it.
Yeah.
Or just get a heated bird bath. I'm sure you sell them. And so they will come in and drink. And on a warm day, they will bathe. Okay. And then again, just shelter. Just leave nature alone and they'll find their own shelter. Or you can keep those snags because then you will have... In a snag, you'll have cavity nesting birds. There's two kinds of cavity nesting birds. There's primary and there's secondary. Primary are the woodpeckers and the chickadees and the nuthatches. They excavate their own little hole. The secondary are the bluebirds and swallows and wrens. They need a hole, but they can't make their own.
Oh, okay? Yeah.
So these are the carpenters of the forest. They create the cavities. And then these are, yeah, like there's six species of ducks in Alberta that are cavity nesting ducks.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know they like stayed in trees.
Yeah.
Only six species.
Oh, really?
Like wood duck, common, golden eye, barrows, golden eye. And then I mentioned nest boxes. So in the city, you could put up bird houses for the red-breasted nuthatch, white-breasted nuthatch, house wren, and tree swallow.
Okay.
That's really only the four species. The mountain bluebird, which we all love, is... out in the countryside.
Yeah. I've only ever seen them out in like Whitepress or the Granbow Ranch.
That's a perfect place.
I've got pictures of them out there.
Yeah.
Let me just ask you then really quick, since you touched on it, because we get asked this a lot.
Yes.
They're feeding them, they have a bird bath, everything that they need, and the birds are in their yard, but they are not using their nesting box. Is there anything they can do? And again, we already said no guarantees. Is there anything they can do to increase the odds, or is it kind of just leave it invisible and when it's ready, it'll go there?
There really is nothing you can do.
Okay.
So again, there's only those few species, right? You will never get an American goldfinch or a robin coming in because they're not a cavity nesting bird. It's only those four species. And so you just have to... put the box out and hope that they will come.
Yeah. And just make sure you've got the suitable food. If they're not in your yard to begin with, you're not going to have them nesting there. So make sure you got food, water, and just stay at it.
Yeah.
Don't give up hope. Perfect.
Well, and plant the plantings and don't use the sprays.
Yes.
Exactly. Leave the dead branches.
Yeah, leave the dead branches. But yes, this is a happy dance. Blueberry.
He literally looks like he's pretending to be a bird. He looks like a kid pretending to be a bird. Look at me, I'm a bird.
Very funny to watch. The female was hauling the grass into the nests and he was just encouraging her.
Yeah.
Telling her she's doing a
rah, 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 rah.
Again, so that's what it is. It's create the habitat and they will come.
It really is. And that's what I love about it is... We got a new place and the garden was dead. It was full of disease and slugs, wasps, just not healthy. And we spent the first year just cleaning, getting rid of the horrible debris, getting rid of the disease, cleaning it up. And by the third year, we had birds were in there. We had dragonflies. We had bees. Everything was where it needed to be. And not one chemical spray. And all I did is start turning the soil, clean out that horrible, like there's a difference between something dead that's structural and something that's just decaying matter. And that's all we did is we just cleaned it up and it's really not that hard. And then we made the environment good for them.
The habitat.
I live way down in the southeast. I live in one of the newer developments, New Brighton. And it's just, you know, you look in the backyards and there's like nothing. There's just grass. And so it's kind of, you have a big empty canvas. You almost feel like it's like a huge task. Like, is this, if my little yard is going to make a difference, right? But I think a lot of the things that you talked about today kind of makes it a little bit more accessible for people like me. You know, we have the tools here. We have seed, we have water, we have differences between the seasons. You know, we can supplement with suet. We can have bird baths in our own little oasis, and maybe that'll encourage more species to show up in my neck.
And
it's not,
you know, something that I think we need to address, because a lot of times when people want to get into a new hobby, and especially one like this, where again, there's no guarantees. It doesn't matter what effort you put in, you might not get. I can go out, like,
How many times has this happened where somebody's like, oh my God, I went out the last 3 days and every day I saw a moose. And you drive 210 kilometers and you're out there for 12 hours. You're like, well, yeah,
that happens to me all the time. Yeah.
Exactly. No guarantees.
Yeah, no.
But you can start very small and then every year add to it.
Yeah. So in your case,
yes,
got some great design ideas in here. So you look at your yard and you're right, you've got this blank canvas. So the thing you want to look at is do it in increments.
Yeah.
But maybe create a long-term plan. Trees are like your big investment, long-term shrubs. You know, the smaller the plant, the perennials and annuals, you can start with just making a few hanging baskets and making a few gardens with the flowers that you know are going to bring the good insects in and attract the hummingbirds.
Yeah.
So yeah, the food, water, and shelter. So
and so
you've got lots of potential.
And you were talked about your Naturescapes Alberta book, which you know, I think I need one now because I feel like, you know, from a beginner standpoint, this seems to be like, I mean, look at all of the plant options and it's just
there's so many. So much that you can choose from.
Yes. And then you said that you have a new book coming out too,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Oh, let's talk about that.
Well, I am very fortunate to have articles published. So I write for the Red Deer Advocate, the Gardener Magazine, and Nature Alberta. Mm-hmm. So in 2016, I did this book called Beauty Everywhere, Nature Photo Essays. So it's a compilation of my columns. And I thought I would have my volume 2 ready for you today. However, I tried to upload it on KDP, Kindle, Amazon, and they've had some technical issue now for almost 3 weeks.
Ugh.
So I just yesterday bit the bullet and I'm paying a huge amount to have it printed locally. So I have to do that. However, I'm really excited because I've improved as a writer and a photographer. So this is soon coming out. But I do have a book out just a few months ago through the North American Bluebird Society. And this is called Get to Know Bluebirds. And it's a guide for bluebirds all across North America. I did it for the North American Bluebird Society. And so it is for all three species, but it's all about bluebirds. So that's pretty fun.
And I know we were talking about this before the show, but, you know, you had this big project with the bluebirds and it was the migration, right? Can we talk a little bit more about that?
I have long been interested in migration because really it is a miracle. And I talked earlier about it being food that determines whether a bird can stay or has to migrate. And so I've been involved over my career with some very interesting technologies that track bird migration. And I'm going to start with the most recent one. And this is called MOTUS. And I encourage your listeners to just go on their website, motus.org.
Okay.
So it's a fairly new technology. This is my house. This is my very smart friend, Mark, who put up antennae. There's CCT and there's low tech. There's two technologies that will detect radio frequency emissions from up to 15 kilometers in every direction. These birds are tagged with special little transmitters. They've got just little tiny antennae, so they have to be outfitted, deployed with them.
Cute.
Yes. And so this is the most exciting so far. So I just had it put up last May, and I had a Swainson thrush come through my yard. So I'm on the south shore of Sylvan Lake, and this is incredible. This thrush was deployed at Whistler in Vancouver.
Yeah.
It came northeast to my place, 650 kilometers. In 20 minutes, it went straight east into Red Deer, where Mark also has a MOTUS tower. That's what they're called. And then it went like 3,500 kilometers to the southeast, to North Carolina, where it was detected. Then it went another 2,500 kilometers straight south to Costa Rica. So it was deployed August 28th. It was mid-November when it was last seen.
Wow.
And so incredible that we're learning all about this migration. We also did a different technology with the mountain bluebirds at Ellis Bird Farm. And these are little, what you call geolocators. So they're light level detectors. And so they just detect when it's sunrise and sunset. And from that, they can determine latitude and longitude. And these little geolocators have a clock in them. And so this picture on the right just shows all of the 14 mountain bluebirds that we had deployed that went down and came back. So generally Northern Mexico and New Mexico.
Wow.
Yes, but the most amazing story, and I still tell this story and I still get goosebumps. And this is a story of a purple martin. So we put this light level geolocator on her in August 24th. She went to Winnipeg on the 27th of August, down the Mississippi Flyway, crossed the Gulf of Mexico, spent 28 days in Belize, continued on down, was on the coast of Venezuela on the 21st of October, went down into the Amazon rainforest, three different roosting areas. They will roost with tens of thousands. So purple martins from all over North America will gather in these same trees. Now, there are a few nesting in Calgary now, so they're just getting established. They're really a central Alberta bird.
Oh, okay.
So the largest swallow.
Okay.
So she had three different roosting areas in Pará, Brazil. On the 24th of April, she decided to come back, and she rocketed back to the same compartment in the same condo in our facility. She traveled a total of 22,000 kilometers. She returned in 21 days. She averaged 600 kilometers a day.
What?
Yes. So from south of the Amazon basin to the same compartment in the same house.
Without Google Maps.
Yeah, without Google Maps. Like, truly, it is a miracle, isn't it?
It is a miracle.
It's incredible.
That's like, that's pure instinct. Like, that you would remember and that, like,
yeah.
Wow.
Well, they used magnetic fields of their planet.
I know, but
they use the stars. I know, but
with
it's
all the
still
chaos we have got, and especially, you know, I could, maybe this would sound more believable. You know, you were talking about, you know, 10,000 years ago, the purple martin and them housing it. But now it seems with all of the chaos we put out there and all of the frequencies and all the towers, and I know that's a whole other subject, but the fact that they're still able to, like, literally pinpoint that, it's not they get to the area and they go, good enough.
Yeah.
They go right back home.
Yeah.
So
it's really incredible.
And purple martins, they like the huge nesting boxes that are room for, like, Why is that? Like, just safety in numbers? Or?
Well, I think it goes back to 10,000 years ago. They hung out all those gourds and the birds just learned to kind of nest together. And then it evolved into actually kind of like a bit of a scandal, if you really want the truth.
Oh.
So what's happened is they will nest. The young female, the male, the old males, so the after second year males, will go up into the sky and they will sing this certain song. And it tells the young males that there's nesting available here in this condo. These young males come down and they go, oh, there's a compartment here. I'll take this one. Then the old males go back up into the sky and keep calling. And that will attract the yearling females who have never bred before. So then the yearling females are flying along and they're going, oh, there's houses here.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll come and land. They'll pair up with the yearling male. And then the old males will force copulate with the yearling females. So it's a bit of a, you know, it's a bit of a scheme.
Yeah.
So they think that there's some sort of weird evolution, that this is how this is all transpired.
Well, I'm glad that humans aren't the only ones with problems.
and it's just because we don't understand it, there's obviously a reason. There's something
it's
happening.
Worked for
there.
Them.
Yeah.
And,
it's worked for them. And then the young males are, you know, usurped. So they don't father the first year's batch.
Suckers.
But then they do the same trick the next year.
Yeah.
So it all works out.
Oh, my gosh. Well, that's so cool.
And
thank you for sharing that.
That's really cool. That is really wild.
Yeah.
Like just 600 kilometers a day.
Yeah.
If anybody is looking for your books, where can we send them? I know that you said the second volume of Beauty Everywhere is going to be coming out shortly.
Yes. So people can go on my website, MyrnaPierman.com.
Okay.
So I will have it in within 2 weeks. I hope that you're going to carry the Naturescape book.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
Sure. And you said that you were on your way to Texas next, right?
Yes. So I was in, big long story, you know, you meet amazing people in life's journey.
Yeah.
So I was in Svalbard, Norway to photograph polar bears in May. And it was interesting. And it was great to be close up to polar bears, but I met some amazing people. So met these Texans who have adopted me, which is great. So I was down there in December and I'm going back down, not only for the eclipse on Monday, hopefully.
That's right.
And then to see, we're going up to a ranch to actually photograph birds.
Nice.
And bobcats, I hope.
Okay. Well, we'll redirect everybody to all of your resources, your website, over on our blog at goldenacre.ca/blog. So make sure to head over there, grab all the links, and then just please involve Myrna in your life, because I think that you're going to really benefit from everything that we talked about today, and also all of the work that you've been doing up until this point and will continue to do.
And in the next week or so, we'll have these in store and online as well.
Okay. So if you're in the area, come by and visit Golden Acre, and you can get your hands on a copy of these books. And if you are, on YouTube, we have our new video podcast out. So we're kind of expanding our own reach. And so we're on YouTube, we're on Spotify, we're on Apple Podcasts. You can reach us on Instagram, Facebook, even send us an email like Alyssa did earlier this week, info@goldenacre.ca. Just put podcast somewhere in the subject line so that we see it. And we have all new content coming up for spring. We're so excited for spring.
Springtime.
Yes.
Webinars are kicking off.
We've got all kinds
of good stuff happening.
Yes, exactly. Right. So we hope that you'll join us as we continue on our growing journey. We'll talk to you next weekend.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you.